Welcome to Knowing God in the Word, brought to you by the Word of Truth Ministry, publishers of Seed and Bread. I'm your host, Bob Juneau, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. This radio program is for the purpose of helping listeners fulfill the greatest need we have as believers, to know God. Today, Nathan will continue his teaching series in the book of the Song of Solomon with The Lord's Fire. And now, Bible teacher Nathan Johnson.
Thanks, Bob. We have been studying the Song of Solomon, a drama in five acts. And we saw it was the story of a love triangle between a country girl, her country boy shepherd lover, to whom she is betrothed, and Solomon, who tries to steal her away from him. Last time we were on the final act, Act 5, and our heroine had been released from captivity in Solomon's court when Solomon realized he wasn't going to be able to force her to marry him or convince her to marry him. And so she had been allowed to go back home with her beloved shepherd, who was now her husband. She, the happy bride, returns home on the arm of her beloved. And we see that those of her hometown, when they see her coming, what they comment on is her, not everything but the new bride, like when Solomon comes home with his latest acquisition for a bride. But now, I think in her words, we learn the theme of this book and the great lesson that makes this a Song of Songs, as we come to Song of Solomon chapter 8 and verse 6, where she says, "Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame." So we saw last time she urged him to set her as a seal upon his heart, that is, sealing that she belonged to him and he belonged to her. She says, "Love is strong as death. Death, once it gets a hold of you, it never lets you go." And then she says, "Jealousy is cruel as the grave." Now, what does she mean by that? That seems kind of scary, almost like she's threatening him. "You had better not give me any reason to be jealous, because jealousy is cruel. Watch out." Well, no, I don't think this is very well translated. I don't think this means jealousy is cruel as the grave, but this means jealousy is inexorable as the grave. And we realize that the grave is inexorable. Think about all the times maybe that you have escaped the grave. You got sick. Of course, sickness always tries to drag us down out of health and toward death, but you shake it off, you get over it. Maybe you have a close call, an accident. We're just a foot or two one direction or the other, and maybe that car would have smashed right into you rather than into the back seat, and you would have been killed. Or maybe if you hadn't just stepped away right before that heavy object fell from the ceiling above you, you would have been crushed. But you escaped. You moved just in time. Well, you escaped the grave, but you don't say, "Phew, I escaped death. Thank goodness. I never have to worry about it again." No, because the grave keeps coming back, doesn't it? You escape it, it's just going to keep coming back. And eventually, one of these times, it's going to get you. Some illness is going to drag you down all the way. Some accident is actually going to happen and kill you. Something's going to take place and you're going to die. The grave is inexorable. It never gives up. And this says that jealousy is the same way. And jealousy, I think, here means the desire for marital exclusivity. And I think this is one of the themes of this book. See, God has made us to be exclusive in marriage. And the desire for marital exclusivity, it's not something that goes away. Solomon had tried to quench it. He had dumped on it by having polygamy. But the desire for marital exclusivity doesn't go away so easy. She says its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. So she says the flames of love and of the desire for marital exclusivity are like flames of fire, like a most vehement flame. But in Hebrew, this most vehement flame phrase, in Hebrew, that's Shalhabeth Yah. Literally, flames of Yah. Now, Yah is short for Yahweh, or Jah short for Jehovah. And so this is that love is flames of Jehovah. And this is the one place where the Lord's name appears in this entire book. Other than here, it doesn't appear anywhere. But here it appears where it says that love is the flames of Yahweh, of Jehovah. And we realize that that's true, as John says in the book of 1 John chapter 4 and verses 7 and 8. He says, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. He who does not love does not know God, for God is love." So love is from God. It's His flame that He lights. And so is that desire for marital exclusivity. That's the Lord's fire. That's something that the Lord puts in each one of us. Now, Solomon has tried to extinguish that flame by just dumping on it with his massive polygamy. And yet that flame, the desire for marital exclusivity, is a fire that the Lord lights. And it's not so easily extinguished. And we realize that as human beings, God has given us a capacity to love that's great. And it's expansive. There's always room to love one more. For example, when you get married and you have a child, you have your first child, you love that child like crazy. You can imagine loving anybody more. You just love that child. Well, then what happens? You have a second child. Well, is your love suddenly divided in half? You only had so much love. And so suddenly you love the first child half as much because you gave half the love to the second child. Well, no. No, you love that first child just as much. It's just now you have love for the second child as well. And you can have a third and a fourth. You keep loving them just as much. You can love however many children you have. And love isn't limited, and you're going to start running out of it. In the same way, friends. You can have friends that you love, and you have another friend that you love. You just add to it. Even the love, like for parents. You can love your parents, but then maybe you can have someone else that you love like a father or like a mother. Or one parent dies, and then you have a step-parent. You love that, come to love that person. You love your grandparents. I mean, love for parents isn't exclusive. And love for siblings. You know, you have siblings, you have another one, you love that one too. Or you can have friends who become so close that they're like a brother or like a sister. Well, that doesn't cut down on your love for your real brothers and sisters. You just add to it. So we have a capacity to expand regarding love. But there are two relationships that God meant to be exclusive, to not be expansive. To be exclusive, that you love just one. And one of those, of course, is your marital relationship. You're only meant to love one man or one woman in the marital way. And you are not meant to expand it. Now, in our society, we seem to be moving back toward expanding. Whether it's polygamy or, if you've ever heard the term, polyamory. You know, polygamy means many wives. There's a corresponding term, polyandry, that means many husbands. But polyamory is just generic. It means love many people in the marriage type of way. It doesn't say specifically whether it's many wives or many husbands. But we seem to be moving toward that. Well, people don't want marriage to be exclusive anymore. Or your serial marriage. You marry one person, then you get sick of them. You marry another person, you get sick of that one, marry another person. Expand your horizons. Or you have an open relationship. You can be married, but maybe another woman comes in the picture, another man comes in the picture. You're all okay with it. Everybody's fine, no problem. It's an open marriage. Well, the problem is that's not the fire that the Lord lights. The Lord's fire is to make marriage an exclusive thing. And though you might dump on it with polygamy or with polyandry or with polyamory or with open marriages and illicit relationships, still, the desire for marital exclusivity is not going to go away. It's the Lord's fire. And it's going to keep coming back. And it's going to keep causing problems. Now, there is a second relationship that the Lord has meant to be exclusive, besides the marital one, and that is our relationship with Him. You know, this world offers many different gods. But the fact is that the Lord intended our love for God to be exclusive to only Him. And yet Solomon was going to soon dump on that love, too. You know, Solomon, he had married all these foreign women. They came to Solomon and said, "Oh, Solomon, I'm just so bored with this worship of Jehovah. I want to worship my old idols that I worshipped when I was a girl." And they'd say, "Well, you don't have to worship those idols, Solomon, but just make me an idol, and I'll worship it. It would make me so happy, dear husband." And Solomon gave in. You know, God's rule was that nobody in his land was supposed to worship any gods but Him. But Solomon gave in and he dumped on exclusivity and love for God when he made idols for his foreign wife. So Solomon dumped on both exclusive relationships that God intended. But this was not right. And God intends the same for us, that we would be exclusive in marriage and that we would be exclusive in our love for God. Verse 7, many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. So she says, many waters cannot quench love. You know, if you build a bonfire, a giant bonfire, well, eventually you dump enough water on that thing, it's going to go out, right? You move a giant furnace and you move it to the bottom of the ocean. Well, it might cause a lot of excitement. It might be a whole lot of bubbles and steam and excitement while it's going out, but eventually it's going to go out. The water is going to put it out. It'll quench it. But love is not that way. It's more like a nuclear fire. You know, you put a nuclear fire at the bottom of the ocean isn't going to put it out. And she says it's the same thing's true of love. Many waters cannot quench love. You could put it at the bottom of the ocean, and the floods couldn't drown it. Love can't be put out that way. And then she says, if a man would give for love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. And that was more or less what Solomon had done to her, wasn't it? He had offered her all the substance of his house. And his house was considerable. He was the richest king Israel ever had. He had incredible wealth. Now, he hadn't necessarily offered it all to her. He'd offered her a lot, but not all his house. Well, even suppose he had offered her everything he had in exchange for her love. She says it would be utterly despised. You would say, what's your household, Solomon, compared to love? And see, that's true. Love is greater than wealth. It's greater than possessions. It's greater than the things of this world. And this is really the meaning of the name of this book. Now, I would suspect that this book probably was originally set to music. It might have been a very stirring song. It might have been very beautiful music, if we could hear it. Yet I don't think that this means this is the greatest music there ever was, the greatest song that anybody ever sang, and that nobody could ever write a better song than this one. No, that's not the meaning of the name Song of Songs. Song of Songs means this is the greatest of all songs, just like Lord of Lords means the greatest of all lords, and King of Kings means the greatest of all kings. But how is this book about the Song of Songs? Well, see, it's about the Song of Songs. It isn't the Song of Songs. Because I think the Song of Songs is love. Love is the Song of Songs. Love is the greatest song there is. And remember that love, like it's pictured in this book, love between a man and a woman, is a picture. Like I said, there are two exclusive love relationships we should have in life. One is husband and wife, and one is us and God. So the husband and wife relationship becomes a picture, a physical picture in the practical real world, we might say, of the love we are supposed to have for God, the love that's supposed to exist between God and his people. And so God's love is what is truly the greatest of all songs. God's love is the Song of Songs. And it's greater than any riches, any wealth. No floods, no water can drown it. It can never be put out. So that's the theme of this book. Well, now in verse 8, we go back in time, and here we have the Shulamite speaking with her brothers. And her brothers are speaking in verse 8. They say, we have a little sister, and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken for? So this is going back in time. Now, remember, this girl's household was under the control of her brothers. And apparently this had happened when she was younger than she is now. Her father had died, and according to their customs at the time, the family business was taken over by his sons. The oldest son would be the new patriarch. Maybe his brothers were assisting him. But he had died while she was still very young. So they're sitting down, and after the grieving process, or their father's buried, they are now looking at accounts. They're going through debts they owe and credits they have, and considering everything as they're taking charge of the business. And so one of the things they have to consider is all the household servants, everybody who's connected with the household, and how they're connected with it, and if they're going to, how they're going to treat them. And so they come upon the matter of their little sister. They have a little sister. And apparently her father, before he died, had seen to it that she was betrothed. And some people today have tried to say the Jews would always get betrothed a year before they got married. Well, that might have happened sometimes or a lot of the time, but see, this girl, they say she has no breasts. She hasn't even hit puberty. So obviously she had been betrothed more than a year before she was going to get married. So they're trying to figure out, what should we do with our little sister? And one of them suggested, well, we could just marry her off and not have to worry about her. Another one says, no, she has no breasts. She hasn't even hit puberty yet. We can't marry her off yet. So what should we do with her? What should we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken for? See, her father had probably promised her a certain amount of money when she got married. See, when she was married, a bridal price would come in. Her new family she's going to marry into paid, her old family paid her father for the right to bring her into their family. And she would now be an employee in their family business. So that money had come in, so now the credit had come in, their father had already received it. So now all that would happen was that money would go out. When she would get married, her father had promised to help set her and her new husband up in business. He wasn't the oldest child any more than she was, so he wasn't going to inherit his family business. But his father was going to set him up with a little flock of sheep of his own, and her father had promised her to give her a little bit of the vineyard, or a little vineyard of her own. And so all the brothers can look forward to is money going out, not money coming in when she gets married. So they're deciding, are we going to honor our father's promise? Are we going to give her the money our father promised when she gets married? What should we do in the day when her betrothed husband comes and speaks for her and says, I want my wife now, and we have to give her away? Well, verse 9, this is their decision. They say, if she is a wall, we will build upon her a battlement of silver. And if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. So they say, we'll leave it up to her. If she's a wall. Remember, a wall keeps trespassers out. We learned what that symbolizes earlier in the book, when her shepherd compared her to a beautiful garden with a wall around it, enclosing it. And we saw that that was a symbol of her purity. She had kept men out. She had kept herself pure. She had kept her virginity. And so they say, if she's a wall, then we'll build on her a battlement of silver. Now, I think this refers to her headdress. And women at the time, on their headdresses, they would wrap a horn that would stick out of the front of their heads, and off of that horn would hang the veil. And it was very traditional. When you were a virgin, unmarried, that horn would go straight out the middle of your head. When you got married, you would move it over to the right, and the horn would come out of the right side of your head when you were married. When you had children, you would extend the horn. You'd make it longer, and that would show that a woman had children. If a woman became a widow, then she'd move it over to the left side, and that would show that she was a widow. But they say, if she's a wall, we will build on her this horn, this battlement of silver. In other words, we'll give her the wealth that our father promised her when she got married. But they say, if she's a door, and what does a door do? Well, a door lets anyone in. It allows easy access. So that would symbolize her not being pure. So they say, if she's a door, then we will shut her up with boards of cedar, with plain boards. We'll just shut her up, and then, yay, we won't have to give out the money that was promised to her. We'll be able to save it. Well, that was a very nice way for them to look at it, because look, as the ones who were now in charge of the family, it was her brother's job to bring her up to be pure. Now that her father was dead, it was their job to teach her purity, to teach her chastity. And yet they're just dumping it all on her, saying, oh, if she's not pure, then we just won't have to pay her marriage price. Yay. Well, that was mighty selfish and not very loving of them. Now she responds to them, verse 10, I am a wall, and my breasts like towers. Then I became in his eyes as one who found peace. So apparently they had not only come up with this rather unfeeling arrangement for their little sister, but they'd actually told her about it. Now, that was very nice of them. So she comes to them now when she returns from Jerusalem, and she reminds them of this agreement. She says, I am a wall. I kept myself pure. I kept anyone else out. And look, she proved it by the fact that she kept Solomon out, the greatest tempter of all. And she says, my breasts are like towers. Now, that's a very blunt way of putting it, that I've hit puberty now. I'm definitely not before puberty anymore. I've hit puberty. I'm ready to get married. And now she gives her evidence that she's a wall. I became in his eyes and Solomon's eyes as one who found peace, or as one who found favor. Solomon liked me, and he wanted me, but I didn't give in. Verse 11, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He leased the vineyard to keepers. Everyone was to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. So she says, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. That means Lord of Abundance. Solomon had an abundant vineyard, a huge vineyard. And when he leased it to vineyard keepers, it was so expensive that they were supposed to bring, in order to get some of its fruit, they were supposed to bring him 1,000 silver coins just to get fruit from this vineyard. Now, it could be that this was the vineyard he had promised her if she would marry him. He knew that she was a vineyard keeper. She loved vineyards, so he promised her a giant vineyard if she would just marry him. And yet she had preferred the tiny little vineyard she'd have with her beloved shepherd. But I can't help but think that maybe this was symbolic. You know, Solomon wasn't just Lord of Abundance and Wealth, he was also Lord of Abundance in women. And could this vineyard symbolize a harem? And could this 1,000 pieces of silver be the dowry to become a bride of Solomon? Or perhaps even a reference to his 1,000 wives. And Solomon, we saw earlier, he was still in the hundreds. He wasn't up to 1,000 yet, but maybe this was even a stated goal of his to get 1,000 women. I don't know. But she doesn't want any of that. Verse 12, my own vineyard is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who tend its fruit, 200. So she says, I have my own vineyard. My little tiny vineyard that Father promised me, and also her shepherd. Her shepherd is her vineyard, and he's hers. She doesn't have to share him with 999 other women. So Solomon, he can keep his 1,000. He can keep his 1,000 wives. And his keepers who tend his fruit, 200. And maybe that's what he would pay to his keepers, their wages. But it could also be his nobles. And the fact is that they're getting many wives too. You know, if the king has many wives, probably his nobles are going to say, hey, wait a minute, how come he gets all the women? Maybe he keeps them happy by giving them multiple wives too. But she says, Solomon, you and your nobles can keep all that. I have a vineyard that's mine, and that's all I want. I don't want to share my vineyard with other women. So we close out with our final scene, the Shulamite and the shepherd together. Verse 13, you who dwell in the gardens, the companions listen for your voice. Let me hear it. So the shepherd speaks to his love. And she is now dwelling among the gardens, notice, out in her beloved country, and not in the palaces and fancy houses of Solomon in Jerusalem. His companions, probably his friends or his fellow shepherds, they're listening to her voice. They love to hear her voice. Probably her voice is beautiful, just like the rest of her. But he asks her to let him hear it. Now he wants to hear more than just to hear her speak, just to hear how nice her voice sounds. I think what he wants to hear is to hear her speak of her love for him. And this reminds me of chapter 5, where the court ladies doubted her love and questioned it, and she, when provoked, spoke of how great her love for her shepherd was. And so I would ask the question I asked there of you. If you were asked to speak of your love for your beloved Lord, the Lord Jesus Christ, would you know what to say? Would you be able to speak of your love for him, or would you be tongue-tied? Would you be stumped? Well, he says, let me hear it, and she lets him hear it. Verse 14, make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag on the mountains of spices. So she lets him hear it. She owns him as her beloved, and he is, of course, her one and only beloved, exclusive. And he is to ever hurry to her side over the mountains. Now, earlier she had spoken of the mountains of Bether, or separation. But now he hurries to her over the mountains of spices, which stands for delights. The mountains of delights, delight in their wedded life together. So this ends the book, and we end with our couple in wedded bliss, together at last in their beloved country life, settled together with the promised funds from her brothers. No doubt they had to give them to her, because that was their agreement. And they have left Solomon and his wealth and his temptations and wiles behind. So that's the book of the Song of Solomon. And in this section of the book, we see the themes of the book. Love and the desire for marital exclusivity are a fire that the Lord himself lights. And all the substance of a man's house is despised next to love. Solomon had despised and dumped on both marital exclusivity and exclusivity in his worship of God. But in the end, Solomon was the one who was the loser. Let us ever keep our love unmixed, both when it comes to our spouses, and especially when it comes to our God. That's the great lesson of the song about love, the Song of Songs.
This Song of Songs is a beautiful picture of the fire of exclusive love that God has kindled in us. While this exclusive love is seen in our marital relationships, God has kindled a fire in us for the exclusive love that we should desire to have for Him. Thank you, Nathan, for your lesson on the Lord's fire. On our next program, Nathan and I will have a short discussion of the book of the Song of Solomon, and then Nathan will teach on the meaning of metanoia. Thank you for joining us today. We trust that you are learning that the more you study God's Word, the more you can know God. For more information on the program, to hear past programs, and for other downloadable material that Nathan has produced, please visit our website at knowinggodintheword.org. For more Bible study literature by Nathan and other Bible teachers, including Seed and Bread Bible studies, please visit the Word of Truth Ministry at seedandbread.org or write to the Word of Truth Ministry, P.O. Box 1609, Canyon Country, California, 91386. I'm your host, Bob Juno, with Bible teacher Nathan Johnson. So long for now. We look forward to you joining us next week on Knowing God in the Word.